Hello all, and welcome to this podcast. We're here at the Unilever Centre for Molecular Science Informatics at the University of Cambridge. And I'm talking to Peter Murray Rust today, who, together with Henry Recepa, developed Chemical Markup Language. And the occasion for our conversation is the 10th birthday, if you will, of Extensible Markup Language, of which CML is a dialect. And Peter, I believe you wanted to say a few words before we formally start the interview.
Yes, thanks very much, Nico. First of all, I'm delighted to have this opportunity to be invited by the W3C to give some of my remembrances, reminiscences of the early days of XML. I'm doing this at short notice from memory, so I haven't had a chance to look everything up, and there may be one or two things which are factually incorrect. The other thing is that I'm very keen on open information, and so this podcast is made available under Creative Commons by CC BY, which means that anybody can do whatever they like with it. They can sell it, reuse it, rework it, and so on. The only thing is that they must acknowledge the authorship and provenance of Nico and me in making this.
Thank you, Peter. So, to get started, maybe it's worth you telling us what your background actually is and how you got involved in XML.
Right, well, I'm a chemist, so I'm slightly out of the run of most of the people who were involved in XML at the beginning. I'm a practicing chemist in molecular informatics, which means I'm interested in how we describe molecules, how we use that information, often in very large amounts. And from this, we can work out how the physical world works and how we can often find out new things about biology and so on from the chemical components that they're made up of. But nevertheless, I have a very strong interest in informatics generally, and that's how I came to be interested in XML. So to give a bit of background, I've always had the vision that information can be used to discover new scientific phenomena. We can go back to the periodic table, which was discovered by Mendeleev from looking at the literature. So we have a big effort here in trying to take the current scientific literature, particularly the chemical parts of it, and to turn it into a formally understandable system for machines, and to try and extract science out of it that wouldn't be visible to an individual human looking at the individual components. So the need to formalise this, to do it in large amount, and to be able to process it automatically is a very exciting opportunity, and XML is part of the technology which starts to make that vision available. How did I get into this? I started many years ago writing programs for chemical computing, particularly crystallography, and realized we needed a formal basis for the information that was lacking. And around about 15 years ago, I started encoding chemistry in a formal manner, and fairly shortly afterwards discovered the World Wide Web from Tim Berners-Lee. I was privileged to be at his closing address at World Wide Web 1 in Geneva in 1994, and was very impressed by his vision of the semantic web, and got the vision that this was possible within chemistry, that we could build systems which used semantics to do things in the real world. So I then looked to where this new technology was going, and Henry Jepper and I, who'd worked quite a lot together on the technology and the vision of intelligent chemical objects, plotted how we were going to do this. Henry went off to WW2 in Chicago and came back with the message that the future of objects on the web was going to be SGML. So that was about 94. And so I built a system in SGML to manage chemistry. Now, those of you who remember pre-XML, in SGML, there were no systems out of the box. There were some bespoke systems which were sold by companies, which were usually very expensive, and they were designed for people who were doing technical manuals in automotive or aerospace, or were involved in publishing, and people who could afford to invest a lot in systems and more were able to take the time to train staff and so on to use these on a daily basis. So when it came to an academic who was trying to adjust this to their own requirements, I found that there were relatively few things that I could get hold of. At that stage, I looked around for what was available. I found NSGMLS from James Clark, which I think is one of the seminal parts of XML. And I also found the COST system, which had been worked on, among others, by Joe English. And Joe taught me much of what I needed to know about structured documents. So in those years or two before XML, I realized the complexity, but also the power of structured documents, that you had something which wasn't just some chunks of words. It was something that you could use in a program, as part of a program, to do things with. It had its own life, and if you built the right sort of software around it, it was able to come alive and do things within the domain. So I worked on that for 2 or 3 years using Tickle, using Java, and then in late 96, Henry pointed out that there was a new initiative on the W3C site, which was SGML in over the web, run by John Bosack, and that this was something we should be interested in. They'd just about come up with the term XML for this, and so I joined the working group. Now, the working group then was a disparate group of, you know, probably about 100 people. It was different from the technical committee, and it was really anybody who wanted to be heavily involved, but not necessarily part of the W3C effort. At that stage, XML was very much a minority activity. It was not on the front page of the W3C, and it was something which was rather specialist activity, documents over the web using this rather heavyweight technology of SGML. And it was primarily primarily supported by people who'd come from the Text Encoding Initiative, and people like John, who'd come from technical documentation. John, of course, came from Sun and has been the shining and guiding light of XML, taking it through all of its processes of having to achieve a vision, the political means to do it with, convincing a community of people it was worth putting time into, and putting in huge amounts of effort to make it happen. So that's roughly where things were at the end of 96. I had joined this working group and I was finding out what this XML was and how it's going to go forward.
So Peter, you mentioned that in the early period, XML was very much a minority effort. Can you describe the feeling a little bit? What it was like working on the language and working with colleagues and friends and the community in general?
Right. Well, in 96, there was still the white heat of the HTML revolution, HTTP, the web was taking off, there were brand new futures, a great feeling of excitement and the ability to change the world. Of course, part of that is still with us, but then I think there was a greater intensity, a smaller community, many of them tracing their roots back to those original meetings in Geneva and elsewhere. So there was another thing to the XML group, that apart from a few people who come in from outside, like myself, there was a lot of shared experience from SGML. SGML had had a tradition of annual meetings run by the GCA, and so people knew each other. They'd come from a mixture of TEI, from document preservation, from High Time, which was an early and very forward-looking hypermedia system, which had explored many of the things that we now take for granted in this. So there was a feeling of community. People knew they wanted to do something. I think they also realised that they had to make their case, because it wasn't seen as a natural thing by the W3C. It was something which would only succeed if we really made an impact on the world. And that is what John managed to get out of this group, to get out of them the effort, the shared vision, the clarity of thought, and so on, that's led to XML today. So there was a very strong, intense feeling. Now, when I joined, I'd had a lot of experience of virtual communities. I wanted to see successful virtual communities. It wasn't something that was all that common for many of the people involved. And I'd also had my experience of the development of standards and protocols, which had been done with and without reference to implementability. So I was very keen that what we developed should be implementable. And so I thought the best way to do this was to create a virtual community with a strong focus on software and testing. So in February 1997, Henry Jepper and I set up XML Dev, the mailing list for developers of XML. Developers of XML systems and so on. And we're very grateful to Imperial College for hosting the mailing list, because this wasn't something that was as easy to do then as it is now. And in the height of XML Dev, we had some 2,000 members or whatever, and we ran it for 3 and a bit years and had over 30,000 emails. If you look back at XML Dev in those days, it was incredibly high quality of discussion. I'm not saying it isn't now, but it is commonplace on mailing lists now to get a lot of noise. There was virtually no noise on this, no flame wars, and so on. Everybody was focused towards making this a success in some way or other. And so one of the things that I did was to moderate this list, not in terms of stopping contributions or editing them, but trying to encourage the group to work towards particular communal goals. And in the first instance, that was creating parsers, which could actually read and validate XML documents against the spec. So the first parser, I think, was Tim Bray's Lark parser. I think NSGMLS was able to parse things as well, but there was a concentration at that stage on Java. John Bozak had given us the vision of Java and XML, the future of the web, and so the parsers were written in Java, and I think this has turned out to be a very happy choice. It's an attractive language to develop in. It's a powerful language to build reusable components in. So first of all, it was Lark, and then Norbert Mikkola developed a parser very much as a response to the needs of the XML dev community. I can't remember what his parser was called. He was able to show that there were things in the original spec which were going to be too difficult to implement. I think they had to do with parameter entities. And as a result, he said, look, either this is going to be too difficult, or I am not clear that the spec makes it clear enough what should be done. And as a result, parts of the spec were actually toned down. And I think this is an important lesson for specs, that you need to have implementability running alongside this rough consensus and running code, as the IETF puts it. And then another parser that came along pretty much at the same time was David Meginson's Aelfrid parser, which was deliberately a very lightweight parser fitted into as small a space as possible. So you had a range of tools ranging from the heavyweight and fully implemented to the lightweight and very rapid tools.
Yeah, and then of course there is there's Sax.
Right. Yes. Now, one of the things that we found fairly early on in XML was that although there was a strong document tradition, there wasn't necessarily a strong tradition of using this in non-document situations. So that the design of SGML was very much that you created a document against a standard, the DTD, and you could validate against this standard so that if it validated, it was then fit for purpose to anybody else who accepted that DTD. So, for example, an author of a document could validate it and then pass it to a typesetter who would know that that was a conformant document because the DTD and parser said so. I was interested in chemistry, and this was a completely new concept for a markup language. And at the same time, people like Jean Paoli from Microsoft were interested in data. And so people like us managed to stretch the design and use of XML so that it moved outside the document and moved to data, moved to representing other things in the real world. And as a result of doing that, we needed software which was able to do more things than validated. And in particular, we needed an API. Once we'd parsed a document, we wanted to get hold of the components of that document. And again, although this was present in things like ESIS and NSGMLS, it wasn't very common. So I started banging on XML dev about how we needed an API for XML. We need something it could be parsed into. And I came up and said, we must have this, a bit of discussion. And then later I said, we really must have it. And people said, mumble, and so on. And then I said, look, we've really got to have an API. And Tim Bray said, yes, we really need to have an API. And at that stage, it took off. And the original name that I produced, YaxAPI, yet another XML API, turned into Sax from David Meginson. So if you like, Tim and I were sort of producers of this. We got it off the ground. But David did all of the heavy lifting in terms of getting a community together on XML dev and guiding us through the process. And it was really a remarkable process. I think at the end of 77, if I get the dates right, David was entombed in Montreal in the middle of an ice storm, and the whole process took a calendar month. Every week he would set us some questions. By us, I mean XML dev. So he said, do you want an event stream model? Do you want it to do Unicode? Things of that sort. And the list would reply, and we got lots and lots of replies, so that I think there are 100 people credited with contributions to Sax. But David had both the vision to take us through and the discipline to curtail discussion every week. And then he went out and wrote the code that implemented what he'd come up with. So it's a remarkable achievement. And at the end of a month, we had the first version of Sax. It worked. It was useful. It did what I wanted. It did what other people wanted. And the roots of that are now in every computer on the planet. So it's Sax doesn't have, a formal body sponsoring it. It had XML Dev, a collection of people who were communally motivated to do it. And when that happens, and it's not often, you get a tremendous sense of achievement at the end of it.
Yeah, it just shows the great power of both community as well as natural disasters or airport lounges to get code written. Those were the early days of XML. How has XML progressed since that time?
Right. Well, the first milestone, which I remember very well, was that John Bosack and John Paoli had managed to get their companies, Sun and Microsoft, to agree to sponsor XML. And this was a major achievement because they were suing each other at the time, endemic in the industry. And I remember John coming back and he had the first draft of XML, and on the back of it, it said sponsored by Sun Microsystems and Microsoft. And this was one of the things that he was proudest of, having got this together. So we now had a spec, we now had agreement that this was going to happen. We still needed to show the world that it was worthwhile, and my own contribution to this was in WWW6 in early 98, where I couldn't be present, but I had agreed with John over the phone and email that we would demonstrate what we could do in chemistry. So I'd written the jumbo parser and browser and display tool in early Java, AWT 1.02. You had to build everything yourself then, menu systems, tree structures, all a lot of it. And I'd done this. And I had something which was able to display chemical documents as chemistry in XML. And so I shipped this to John. We still had fairly, it still wasn't trivial to ship things over the web, jar files and so on, but John got that. And the idea was he would demonstrate something at WW6. Now, I'm never quite sure what he demonstrated. I'm not sure whether the demo worked or whether it ran earlier and he'd got some screenshots or whatever. But there was enough there to convince people that this wasn't just a document language. It was a language of great power in all sorts of disciplines. So this was beginning to catch on, the idea that XML was an all-purpose language. And I had foreseen that it would take off as a content language, and because the mathematics community had started to use it for maths, because the graphics community had got it for graphics, SVG, the multimedia community, Smile, and so on, I thought it would be relatively universal for people to create content in XML. And one of the visions was that XML would be the lingua franca of information transmitted over the web, that you would create your XML documents, send it over the web, that the client would have tools which were able to deal with it, and the two tools which were being developed at that time, the two other things in the triptych of XML were XML link, linking with XML, much of it informed by HiTime and other hypermedia systems, and XSL, XML style sheet language. Now, XLink has turned out to be somewhat different. It's probably now mainly embodied in RDF and other aspects of the semantic web. XSLT has been, I think, one of the great successes of XML. It's shown that you can have not only the ability to transform documents into all sorts of different ways, but it also showed that XML itself could be used as a declarative language. So XSLT is, although unfamiliar to many people used to procedural language, is a great example of how XML can be used outside of its original document format. However, at that stage, what happened was something that certainly I hadn't anticipated. It suddenly became clear that it was an excellent language for developing middleware and supporting information processes. So in a sense, a lot of the effort of XML went into not into content representation, but the representation of processes. So you've got things like SOAP for passing messages in XML, you've got log files in XML, you've got servers whose infrastructure was based on XML, and so forth. And in a sense, the attention of the world moved in that direction rather than content. And content has been moving along, not as fast as I thought, And looking back, it's actually taken 10 years for content languages to become established. And even then, there are not huge numbers of them. There are quite a lot which represent well-established formal processes in the real world, so things like financial products, markup language, and so forth. But when it comes to using them to create a new vision of how content can work, there aren't all that many of them. So that is where I think we now have an opportunity to take off, and I'll say something about that later.
Sure. So then let's talk a little bit about where we are today in terms of XML, and you've already mentioned RDF and the semantic web a couple of times. So where does XML need to go? Where ought it to go in the future? What's the relationship of XML with other semantic web with respect to other semantic web technologies such as RDF and OWL? Could you comment on that a little bit?
Right. Well, the first thing to be clear about is XML is now part of the fabric. John Bosack described it as the digital dial tone. In other words, XML is everywhere. In a way that, let's say, 20 years ago, everybody started becoming acquainted with the hierarchical filing system. Everybody now understands file systems. 30 years ago, they didn't. So now the generation of people in education coming into universities are all familiar with XML if they're involved in any of this technology at all. You don't have to explain it. They've got ways of picking it up and so forth. They know that you need tools to process it and so on. So it becomes a creative environment in a way that it wasn't 10 years ago, where you really had to labour and slog through everything. So what does XML do well? Well, XML represents very formal systems well. If you have a contract, let's say, between the tax authorities and the individual, and you want to represent a tax form formally, then XML is a pretty good way of doing it. You must have this, you cannot have this, you can optionally have that, and so forth. And you must fill in a number here, you must fill in a zip code here of the following form. So that is done very well. Many real-world processes require that, but the majority don't. So that when we come to science, and I'm probably going to digress on science mainly at the moment, you have a fluidity and a flexibility which XML, as it stands with schemas and DTDs, is too rigid to manage. If we have chemistry, for example, must a molecule contain atoms? Probably, but not absolutely. You can think of molecules where you don't know what the atoms are, but you know they're still molecules. Must a molecule with atoms have chemical bonds in? Definitely not. Many do, but many people, like my colleagues in material science, say they have no need for bonds. They don't describe it. So you can't lay down rigid rules about whether you should have atoms, whether you shouldn't, and so forth. So the content model of XML schema is too rigid for us. What we're finding at the moment is that XML provides a very good way of defining those nouns in our vocabulary which are well defined. So we pretty much understand atoms, we pretty much understand spectra, we pretty much understand what a chemical reaction encompasses. Not necessarily all the nuances, but we understand that this is a reaction and not a molecule and so on. So we can put those labels on, and it works very well for that. But in terms of taking that further, then you need something more flexible. And I think that's where RDF comes in. Now, RDF, in principle, allows you to say anything, but if you say everything in XML, then in RDF it becomes so complicated that it becomes very very difficult to make any sense of it. So what we see is a balance between XML and RDF, where the XML represents formally those things which we understand well, and the RDF allows us to put different interpretations on it. We may have something intermediate, and one of the things that we're developing is relaxing schemas for different, if you like, dialects of CML. So we find some people who say you must have this in chemistry, and other people who say you might have it, and other people who say, well, we can't see any use for that at all. And the way that we're developing this is to come up with what we call conventions, and we're exploring the use of relaxing to define these conventions, but using the standard CML components that we've already developed. So to give an example of a standard component, if you have a molecule which has a number of atoms in, you can calculate the molecular mass. You add up all the atoms, the mass of all the atoms multiplied by the number of times they occur, and then you end up with the molecular mass. And that is going to be a standard algorithm regardless of what else you do with the molecule. So that's hard-coded into our software as part of CML. It's a given within the language. Similarly, if you want to calculate the distance between two atoms in three-dimensional space, you know that you can pull the coordinates out because they're in the schema. You can apply Pythagoras' theorem, and that'll give you the distance between the atoms. You can't describe that sort of thing in RDF or XML schema or relax, and it's just a higher level of domain-specific semantics, which you have to build into the software in various places. So we see a mixture of different components at this level. We're also very conscious in CML that no set of vocabulary is going to describe it all. So CML has a vocabulary of about 100 elements, 200 attributes, and that's more than enough to be going along with. It takes all our time to keep up with the software to manage that. So the way in which you extend CML is to use dictionaries. Those dictionaries describe all of the concepts that people need. So, for example, melting point is a concept in the dictionary. It's not part of CML. CML describes this as a property, and when you go to the dictionary, you find out what the point of that property is. And we do that by having links from the document to the dictionary. The links are managed by an attribute called dictref, reference to a dictionary, but we will need RDF to tell us how the dictionary behaves. And Andrew Walkinshaw in our group has developed a system called Golem, which will take a corpus of XML documents and extract from it what are the compatible dictionaries and whether another document is compatible with those dictionaries. So that's one of the ways that we see this fluidity developing. Another is that I've been disappointed by the relatively small lack of support at client side for XML. The vision that I picked up in very early days of XML was that if you had an XML document, you put it on the server, you transmitted it over the web, and when it came to the client was able to do magic things with it by applying style sheets, by applying general and specific XML software. Now, much of the web has gone back to a vision where you use the XML at the back end, you transmit it through all the middleware, but when it comes to the final service, that service translates it into HTML or Flash or GIFs or whatever. It removes the semantic from it. And while this may be useful for commercial applications, it means that in science, you're not actually passing science over the web, you're passing snapshots of science. That's not universally true. So, for example, the National Center for Biotechnology Information, NCBI, of the National Institutes of Health in the US, passes genomes and protein sequences and bibliographies and so on in XML, but it's probably an exception rather than commonplace that this is done. So what I'm hoping is that we can get to a stage where there's greater support for client-side XML, if you pass something with a namespace over the web to a client, that client ought to be able to resolve that namespace. It ought to be able to find tools which can do something exciting with it, that should be done independently of the operator of that client having to know that these exist. So we really need much more intelligent clients which can resolve this using a mixture of namespaces, RDF and so forth. In terms of OWL, I'm agnostic at the moment. I'm now a strong believer in RDF. I'm still struggling to familiarise myself with all of the syntax and rules and so on. But Nico's a great help here. In terms of reasoning, I see RDF schema allowing you to do things like subclassing as being valuable. But whether we'll get to fully fledged reasoners in physical science, I don't know. I don't think it's top priority. I think top priority is getting the domain-specific components of the software installed at the moment.
Right, and you would see that very much part as part of a roadmap for XML for the future.
XML in science, yes. Science is a small part of XML. XML took off very much in the late 90s as supporting early 2000s supporting commerce and server-side technology, and that's fine. So we've got to work pretty hard if we're going to get science as something which influences the direction of XML. And one of the problems I have is that for every good and usable standard that come or recommendation that comes out in XML, we also have heavyweight standards which are too hard for scientists to take up. So if you take XML schema, worthy though it may be, with a several hundred page specification and a 40 page primer to get you to understand it, that's too much to expect as a scientific discipline to take on board, which is why things like relaxing are important, but why also we see things like REST as more important for SOAP in scientists for sciences which don't have huge infrastructural support. It works in bioscience because there's a lot of support there, but when you come to what Jim Downing calls long tail science, that huge mass of science where the unit is a 20 person lab, you've got to have very simple ways of implementing things or people are not going to do it. So we're looking to develop very lightweight technology which supports XML and RDF for physical and other sciences.
So to put it slightly flippantly, it's important to accommodate the occasional hacker or the scientific hacker.
It's critical. Yeah. XML started with hackers, you know, the people I've mentioned, you know, were hackers. They weren't paid members of large organisations. We're very grateful to all of the companies which sponsor XML, either directly or indirectly, but it had its roots in hackerdom. And as far as science is concerned, much of that is going to flourish through scientific hackerdom. So we need a few more tools in there, some more generic tools. Goodness, we want a stable platform for SVG. I mean, SVG is epitomised, would be epitomised if it was the graphical language of science. We need that semantic stuff. And we really need a time where you develop an SVG application and 6 months on, you can rely on it still working.
Yeah. So you already described the early intense work on XML. I mean, how has XML affected your life, if you will?
Well, when I started it, I'd had this heady vision, which I still share, of the power of the web, which came from WWW1. The XML years reinforced that. I was living in a dream for much of the time. I was running a virtual school at Nottingham University, where we had people from all over the world. We'd run the Principles of Protein Structure course in 94 on the first fruits of the multimedia web. So I had enormous belief in the power of virtual communities to change the world, and I still do. We're hoping to do this in different ways with Wikipedia and the Blue Obelisk and other things like that. I took time out from chemistry during that period because rather than try and develop chemical markup language head-on with its own technology and so on, I thought that if my little effort could go into helping XML succeed, then that would pay back, because then I could ride on the back of all of that infrastructure. And that's actually what's happened. We're now convincing people that CML works because it's got this XML infrastructure. You don't have to justify XML. You can go out and find tools and so forth. So I'm still in that sort of atmosphere. It's mellowed a bit because it always takes longer than you think. But if it hadn't been for XML, I wouldn't be here in Cambridge. I was able to get things off the ground. And if it wasn't for the fact that I was in Cambridge, I wouldn't now have all of these people around me who are making things buzz. So that we now are starting to use XML really as a creative tool for expressing ourselves, not for representing really rather barren formal systems like tax forms and so on, but using it as a semi-natural language to talk about the science in the way that we want to talk, building those systems that make it work. It's a mixture of formality and improvisation. We've got to accommodate the way that a very diffuse community comes up with its own ideas. The major areas that we're working in now, I suppose, are roughly threefold. One of them is publishing, so that publishers such as the Royal Society of Chemistry are taking up some of these ideas and using CML in their components. And it's valuable that publishers as a community used SGML from the early days, so we don't have to convince them of the value. And I think there will be a lot more excitement over the next few years in the use of XML in scientific publishing. Then I think we've had some remarkable work in using it for chemical computing. Traditionally, chemical computing uses Fortran programs with a very arcane legacy outputs. Many of these are 30 years old or more, and it's almost impossible to get the input of one program from the output of another. So we've been converting the programs to optionally output XML, and a lot of this work's been done by Toby White in Earth Sciences in Cambridge. Toby's developed the FOX system, which is a library for XML in Fortran, and that's a labour of love if ever there is one, because Fortran is not forgiving for object-oriented programming. Yes. But he's done it. You can now write XML and CML out, and it acts as a wonderful, liberating thing. It's difficult to explain how much creativity simply turning things into XML is, and until you've done it, you don't realise it. But we can now do things that we simply couldn't do before using XML. And then the third area is in the whole area of understanding chemical systems and their properties. So we're doing this partly because we're supported to do this by Unilever. So Nico heads up our polymer informatics group, and Nico and I have developed polymer markup language together. Now, polymer markup language relies on the fact that polymers, things like polythene or funny putty or starch or whatever, are not single compounds, they're fuzzy systems. They're full of molecules of different lengths and chemical variability. And until we found out how we could put that variability into the system, we couldn't model them. Now we can. Chemical markup language through polymer markup language supports these polymer systems, and that's given us a new lease of creativity. Because we're also interested in how we make compounds, we've had to capture chemical recipes, and here the declarative power of XML has become important. We can write down a recipe which a computer can in principle execute. We can take something like a thesis, turn it completely into XML. Nico's thesis, for example, we've been looking at it and it's got 200 new compounds in there, and we've been able to turn those recipes into XML, and the computer can now analyze them, find out the common ways that reactions have been applied, and could in principle issue a series of instructions to a machine to remake those compounds and so on.
And the most remarkable thing, certainly during the time that I've been here, is that XML really has brought together very, very different and disparate fields. So you mentioned polymers already. At the same time, we're interested in material science. We're interested in publishing, and now we can start to combine all the various technologies that we've developed. And because the problems across science are pretty much the same, and one of the uniting factors is certainly CML / XML in all of this. So that said, and very briefly to conclude, where do you think is, beyond what we've already discussed, where do you think is XML heading, and where should it go?
Well, my personal vision is that we shall move to a stage where in science all scientific information is encoded in XML at some stage. At the moment we're having to labour to get it out of Word documents, out of PDF documents and so on. But Word has moved to having an XML output, which is actually, in the latest version, reasonably tractable. So if we get to a stage where all scientific documents are authored in XML compatible tools, it doesn't have to be Word, there are other authoring systems, but if they're authored in that, if the chemistry, the maths, the graphics, the tables, the protein sequences, the pictures of the gels, if they're all encoded in XML, then you have something which is understandable not only by humans but also by machines. And then you have the vision of the fully semantic web, where the objects on the web, besides the words, are searchable. So you can search for molecules, you can search for differential equations, you can ask your machine to integrate the differential equations, you can put in all of the reactions that describe our atmosphere. We're doing this with the Atmospheric Chemistry Group in Cambridge, working out a way of encoding both the maths and the chemical reactions into markup language, so that then you could ask the computers to model the reactions in the atmosphere. At that stage, you then start to get emergent properties, that you get machines which talk to machines, you get documents which talk to documents, without the need for humans to intervene. You get autonomous systems. We, for example, have an autonomous system which every day goes out and reads the chemical literature, pulls out the crystallographic information and turns it into an XML knowledge base. It's called CrystalEye. It's all been done by a third year PhD student, Nick Day. He's done a remarkable job, but we couldn't have done that without XML. As you get more and more of these emergent systems coming, you'll suddenly find that you get a limited amount of intelligence. Now, I don't want to be too science fiction-y about it, but most developments in artificial intelligence over the last 30 years have actually been small incremental developments in representation and heuristics. And I can see that we will start to get to a stage where you can ask questions of the scientific web, and because it has all of that knowledge encoded, and that, by the way, is why I'm so keen on making this knowledge openly accessible. Not all of it is. That's a different podcast, right? Yes. When we do that, we'll be able to ask the web questions, and the web will be able to answer it. And if it doesn't know the answer immediately, be able to ask other bits of the web what they know about it and bring it back to us. And I think it's going to be tremendously exciting.
Peter, thank you very much for your time and for the interview, and thrilling times ahead.
Thank you very much, Nico.